Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And maybe the microphone, if my voice drops, tell me. I'm just going to read from the collection. It's divided into four sections. The first section is called Learning to Swim, and they are poems of childhood, of ancestry. So the first one, I live, as Stephen said, in North Lincoln, so Knocknarea, Queen Maeve, all of that, that's my home territory. This is called Painting the Dreamtime. To show what it was like, Kilura, Carramore, Knocknarea, the waves full in, flint grey, swimming green, lilac sky. To catch the luminous from within, light up from beneath, Aboriginal light, to make the paper shine beyond reserved white. And here in the land, to show the people who lived before, who sang a cairn, who sang a circle of bones, who sang hawthorn and blackberry bush, who sang sheep, grasses, children, deer. My father's people were lighthouse keepers. The last lighthouse member of the family is my uncle Frank, retired in 1951. My father and my sister do a big family history, genealogy, and then I steal from them and turn them into poems. So this is called The Lighthouse Keeper's Daughter. And where are you from? And who are your people? From men who lived on wave-washed rocks, who learned well the virtues of silence. From women who lived on rain-washed land, who tended to potatoes, worrying about the harvest, who prayed every morning, remembering the family, who raised children alone, giving thanks every night. From women who loved for the blue of their eyes, their sea-struck, rock-bound men. From men who came home after weeks on a rock, to potatoes and school books, to squabbling and bills. From men who had forgotten the taste of their wives. From women filled on the first night home with the nameless passion of waves. From the burning thirst hunger of men who were belly deep, bones deep, balls deep, filled with wave and rock and wind and salt. From men who came home to wives who were concubine. From women whose husband's first wife was the sea.
Wow.
And then from the other side of my family, there's Maura here, and I, we both run AWA writing workshops, probably another writing workshop. There's a poem by a woman called Georgella Lyon called Where I'm From, and it's just taken off as a writing workshop trigger. And because I run writing workshops, I call this poem Where I Am Number 28, because I use it all the time. From Aunties and the Missions. From my mother's first cousin praying for vocations, 15 decades of the rosary while she milked the cows. From her three daughters in India, sending home letters on frail blue paper pinned from circling the globe, each letter ending with a cross. From my own mother's letters, scattered with DGs and DVs, Deo Gracias, Deo Volantes. From the grand Latin god of letters and the homely vernacular god of the kitchen, my aunt saying, Jesus, Mary and Joseph, that's not a curse, that's an aspiration. From the sacred heart with a crown of scary thorns. From one failed priest who left to marry his love, and two successful priests, both living and dying in their lonely boots, both singing in the end the praises of marriage.
Wow.
This poem is dedicated to my grandmother. She died 30 years ago. She developed Alzheimer's, and it's called Islands of Mind. It's a memory of Mary Houlihan Mayburns. On her way to communion on Sunday, in her blue and cream turban, her fox fur stole, her flecked tweed coat, there was no sign to show she was lost at sea, with no landmarks, no lighthouse, no compass, no stars. adrift from the moorings of her mind, she once stood in the doorway of your bedroom and said, "Who's that strange man in your bed?" The strange man was your husband. Life had fallen back to a time when you were a girl, before men and beds. Sometimes she knew enough of who she was to know who she was not. How far she had drifted from the sharp mind of the mathematics teacher, the mother of five, the mistress of the house, the one-time lover of a long-dead husband, the keeper of a garden with apple trees. Small islands of knowing, frantic to not disappear again into the mist that she knew in each terrifying moment of anxious lucidity was her usual state. Her islands of mind grew smaller. So there are four sections. I'm going to read four or five poems from each section. The second section is called Facing Into the Fire, and most of the poems that came out of time I spent in Africa are here. Partly poems about fire in the sense of passion, partly poems about fire in the sense of conflict. I've just come from the Lismore Travel Writing Festival, and I read on the opening night on the Thursday night. I think it's the first time they've had a poet reading at a travel writing festival. It was enormously good fun. So I went to Nairobi 30 years ago last Wednesday, and this poem is called Mango. Nairobi, 1983. The first day and the first question. Are you married? And why not? And the first gift, a mango, the warm blush of it, given by a man in a market stall to welcome me. The delicate curve of it coming to a shy point, and later the taste, all juicy strangeness and intensity wrapped around a long, hard stone, and then those stringy fibers in my teeth for days. In the course of my work, I travelled to a number of countries. So this one comes from Angola. I don't speak Portuguese, so it was the country in which I had least connection with people. One Sunday afternoon, myself and another Irish woman and a Spanish man called Carlos, who spoke Spanish and therefore could communicate, went out for a walk and ended up where some squatters were living in old railway carriages. So this is called Rosalina Silva. Walking through the barrios of Luena with Carlos to the old engine yard, the old engine's all rusting magnificence and brittle yellow weeds tall between the tracks. Meeting the squatters who live in the carriages, brewing dinner and hooch with nothing to do on a sleepy Sunday but squabble and drink and wait for oblivion. Among them, Rosalina Silva, gap-toothed and gleaming, old before 30. I asked to take her photograph. Carlos translates. She asks why. I say, because you're beautiful. She says, I'm not beautiful, but you are, I tell her. The others gather around, and again someone asks, why? What's in it for us? Nada, nothing, I say, only friendship. They all laugh and applaud. This is a good answer. In 1994, when the genocide happened in Rwanda, 800,000 people were killed, I was in Kenya. So I wasn't there at the time. But anybody who was touched by it was touched very deeply by it and had to come to terms with it in some way. Troy Keane has written about it very movingly. I wasn't there at the time, but in 1999 I went there and I went through Okra to do an evaluation of a psychosocial project. And while we were there, we were brought to visit three genocide memorial sites, which at the time I felt was too many. It was truly harrowing. But this one, Murambi, was that there was a sense of sacredness in it, unlike the other. There is another poem here, which I won't read. But there was a sense of sacredness in Murambi, which maybe brought some healing when I came. It took me 5 years after the event to even write these poems. This called Murambi. We walk through each room as if it were a prayer to walk through these rooms of lying bleached skeletons, and the great hall with rope after rope strung across its width, draped with trousers and shirts, bright skirts and kitenge. An unintended art installation in the still silence of the mountainside. The man with the bullet wound still visible in his forehead, as neat as a shilling, showed us around. He had fallen beneath the bodies of these people, his neighbours, and stayed there until the machetes had fallen silent, the blood congealed, and he somehow found safety. In the car driving back into life, someone begins to speak of everyday things, begins to cope, begins to tidy away the shock, the sacred. I also worked in South Sudan amongst the Dinka and the Nuer people, and they are people of the cow. They have these enormous herds of long horned cattle. And when I worked with them, they were internally displaced because of war in South Sudan. This was in 1993-94. And what I came to understand was that they lost their homes, they lost their land, but they also lost their cattle. And the cattle for them were economy, they were kin, they were spirituality, they were culture. So this is a short poem, it's called The People of the Cow. We had to leave the cattle behind. The lovely white cow with the long horns and the nap of her hide smelling of smoke. We, who had minded her from the beginning of time, milked her for milk and blood, sung to her every night of her lovely life in the cattle camp. Without her, we wander the world half human, bereft of our song, our reason for singing. And then somehow you have to come to terms with these things and come back into life. And I mentioned Ferdy Keane, his book about Rwanda and the genocide is called Season of Blood. And he's got a quote in it that is, "My dreams are the fruit of this journey down the dirt road to Nairobi." So this poem is called Dreaming in a Season of Blood. And it's a dream poem. I kissed your neck. You grew still with pleasure. The air between us, warm like a cave. A woman screamed. I woke, 5 a.m. again. Last night, it was bodies in the jungle, machetes, the smell of decay. And tonight, what will it be tonight? How can I dream sweet kisses? Because the world needs this, to kiss and be kissed, to grow still with pleasure. So, as Stephen said, in 2005 I moved to North Leitrim, bought a house, and I shifted from being employed to being self-employed, but that was okay because I was in a job that, you know, was moderately secure, and I screwed up my neck really badly, and I still had a mortgage. So thereby hangs a long other tale. But after I'd been there for a year, I finally was able to join the Gondoran Writers Group and to begin to write again. And I dream. I pay attention to dreams, and sometimes poems come out of them. And sometimes there are dreams that say, no, do not go down this road. And sometimes there are dreams that say, yes, do go down this road. So the night after I went to the Gondoran Writers Group, I dreamt this dream. It's called "And Yes, the Waves Are Sparkling." An elephant was trapped in the underground, in some version of hell. There was fire, and certainly its torment. Above ground, God was standing at a cross in the road, and I was complaining, as I do. Too much torment, God. Too much. God paid me no mind, as he does in dreams, pays me no mind. Just showed me a road down to the left, to a bay that was not exactly Donegal Bay, but not exactly not. And showed me there an orchestra of dolphins swimming in great synchronized swoops with whales and seals and the sun, and the sea was the happiest, bluest turquoise I had ever seen. Mm. of writers group, kept her letter, and Mess, the man who is now my beloved, there also. So that was another reason to stay, which I didn't know at the time. The next section in the collection is called Drinking Tea with Angels. I take them as you will. They're dream poems, they're active imaginations, they're questions and attempted answers. The first poem in this section is called A Third Church. I was raised, as I think maybe clear already, in a profoundly Catholic home. And I think there is a journey. Everybody makes their own journey in response to that. So for me, there was a journey away and some kind of a return to something. But anyway, this is called A Third Church. Tantum ergo sacramentum, Latin, and the priest faced away. Would you hear the slap when the bishop made you a soldier of Christ, or would it be just a tap? And who would he call to answer, and what have you forgot? Would the nuns tell him beforehand which of the girls to ask? And the altar boys, the host, the sounds of golden bells, the round white O held up, a big one for the priest to break, small ones for the rest of us. It mustn't stick to the roof of your mouth. If it touches your teeth and you die, you go straight to hell. No, don't. And may you be in heaven half an hour before the devil knows you're dead. A different church. The grannies and the rosary beads, the soft, dull chant. Being told to give out the mystery, the glorious, joyful, sorrowful, the Garden of Gethsemane. When your turn comes round, you must remember not drift away on blurry murmurs. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. A constant rhythm in grannies. A constant fight at home. Staying out late, running wild around the estate. Long summer and the sounds of girl boys. Not wanting to go in. She'd let it go for weeks. We'd drift, we'd win. And then a darkness in her inner vision. So what she sees is hell and her own lost children. She tries to rein us in. We strain against her rein. We squirm against our kneeling chairs, against the weight of guilt and fear. For years she tugs and pulls. We tug and pull. For years we break away. There was a third church. Golden candles, golden monstrance, scents of incense, airy heights, Mary crowned with stars, and over all, tiny, loving tiles, blue, starry night.
Thank you.
So, this is the Drinking Tea with Angels poem. It's called Drinking Tea with Little Ceremony. The Annunciation fascinates me as an archetype of this great, powerful otherness, calling, requiring a transformation, requiring some fundamental yes, some fundamental change. This is sort of a pre-annunciation dream poem. It's called Drinking Tea with Little Ceremony. His wings fill the kitchen with their power, as if every feather were muscled, each with its own source of strength and fire. As for his body, it was hairy, covered in a rough golden down. He stood saying nothing, and I went about my work, watering the plants, making tea, waiting. Without ceremony, he sat at my table, took the tea I had poured for myself, handed it back for more sugar, all without saying a word. Nothing else happened that day. He drank his tea and went away. But I was wearing my red shawl, and the oilcloth on the kitchen table was red. It was harder to wait, as something was being waited for. My angels seem to always want more sugar in their tea. Here's a short poem just called Otter. It's self-explanatory, I think. Searching for the shape of a prayer. What shape a prayer might take if I decided to pray. I saw an otter down by the water, slinky beautiful, her tail like an eel or a snake, but we have no snakes. Whipping between reeds, searching for fish, her long, narrow spine, the sinuous S. There's a poem by a woman called Caelan Haught. The poem's called God Says Yes to Me, and the opening line is, I asked God if it was okay to be melodramatic, which I think is a fine opening line, and this poem is my response to that poem. My poem is called Cassiopeia on the Saxophone, Orion on the Guitar, the Great Bear on the Drums. I asked God if it was okay to just be here with cold toes on a soggy, wet August day in a room full of women and one man, talking about words and beauty and the smell of coffee going stale in the background and the sound of cars slushing through water and fretting about aquaplaning and slick roads going home. And God said, "Oh my goodness, so many questions. Breathe, girl, breathe." And I said, "Okay, I'll breathe." Then I asked God if it would be okay to be rich. And she said, "Honey," she calls me that too, oddly enough, though not sweet cakes, at least not yet. She said, "Honey, you are rolling in gold, you are dripping in juice, you are beaded with amber." "Oh God, that can't be right, it all sounds so lush," I said. God said, "Never you mind, your God is a lusty God. How else do you think I made the world?" "Me and him," she said, "we rolled together in the mud and way down low beneath the sea, away up high where the stars are jamming wild, Cassiopeia on the saxophone, Orion on the guitar, Great Bear on the drums. All I need from you, girl, is your dancing shoes and your breathing body. Breathe." Creation poem. And then to come back to the Annunciation, this is one of the first poems I ever published 15 years ago. It took me a while to come back to it. It's called Afterwards. It's a short poem. How is it for Mary, afterwards, with Joseph? Having known the angel, was she restless with the man? Or did she love him more, her everyday man, and better than before? Okay, and the last section of the poem in the book is called Earth in Our Palms, and there a lot of these come from after I'd injured my neck, which was, you know, after all the flying in Africa and movement was sort of coming down to earth. I have a long, 3-page long poem about injuring my neck, but I have also a very short poem which I'll go with tonight. It's called Gift of the Dark. Emptied of solar brilliance, perfection, accomplishment, money, abilities. Prepared by tenacious failure for a small task and a vast vision, fruition, though it doesn't seem to fit false logic. What has to be burned to be cured? What has to be deepened? The soil, luminosity, the truth of the moon. Miss Travis, I'm not sure if I've read this reading before. Near where I live in Sligo, there's a place called Holy Hill Hermitage. It's run by hermit Carmelites. They sort of live their own separate hermit life, and they have cottages available for anybody who wants to come stay there. You don't have to. It's not like a directed retreat. There are places just available, and I go there and I write or I paint or I just read or I hang out or I sleep over there. And so this came out of a visit to one of these. It's called The Mother of the Mother of Life. Each hermitage has the name of a saint. Mine is Anne, at the far end of the long field. I'm doubly pleased. No one walking by my window, no voices, no prayers, no bells. And Anne, am I ready to live with her for a week? The Anne I know is Da Vinci's cartoon, the Virgin and Child with St. Anne and John the Baptist. Mine is palm-sized. I've seen the original in London, I've seen the original in London, over 1.5 meters tall, and not a cartoon, only that he was sketching loose chiaroscuro chalk on smoky paper, allowing space for paradox. His Virgin is a mother of joy, ripe as a plum, holding her round-limbed baby with a smile, who is reaching out toward his cousin, who is kneeling, asking to be blessed by this child, who is both infant and wise. Anne sits behind Mary, behind and beneath. Her left hand raised to heaven, Mary on her lap. Their legs and laps overlap. It's hard to tell who's holding whom. Anne's face is at the core of this creation. The skull beneath the skin, the hollow darkness of her eyes. She is death to Mary's life. On my first night in the Hermitage, I dream of a long-dead friend. She tells me she only visits those who need to see her. I sit beside her, touching. My breath catches with grief. Breath fills my lungs. Then she's gone. I am ready to live with Anne, the mother of the mother of life. And then a shift for the last three poems. As you travel on the bus from Dublin to Ballyshannon, near where I live, you pass through Swanland Bar. I'm not entirely sure whether it's in North Cavan or South Fermanagh. I think it's in North Cavan. So there's a short poem called Cow Duck, Cow Goddess. When I read this my poem to my mother, she said, "Don't tell me you do that." I said, "It's okay, that's a poem." So Cow Goddess. There was an old enamel bathtub in a field south of Swanland Bar. Sometimes I bathe there. On full moon nights and on holy days. The cows are my attendants. Sometimes they lick me with their barnacled tongues. First to work. Okay, this is called Holly. Two more, this one and one more. Walking in the half-woods, I met a man in an orange busy vest, bright against the bare-limbed trees, the grey ice lake, the snow-clotted conifers. He has managed forests, he tells me, for 22 years. He walks the woods with an assessing eye, judging what to clear away, undergrowth and the unwild, the lodgepole pines that block the light, and what to keep, specimen trees, native trees, how best to make spaciousness for fauna, how best to make a welcome for the old wildlife. He is, I'm thinking, the archetype of the gardener, as much concerned with pruning as with growth. I tell him I have heard rumours of deer. He points out an alder, that has to go, but the holly, he nods toward the stretch of land between the path and the lake, that should go, but I won't cut it back unless they tell me to. And anyway, he says, if you coppice holly, it just grows back more densely. We both know he's inventing reasons for an irrational affection. He just likes holly, smiles fondly on her, indulges her wild danglings. This last poem is called Knucklebones. Tom, who can't be here tonight, gone home to Leitrim, is a novelist, and he's got a novel coming out about, it's called The Cursing Stone. So in 1884, a British Navy gunboat was going to Tory Island to either collect wreck or evict the islanders, and that was going to mean evicting the islanders. The ship sank on the rocks below the lighthouse, and 50 men died, six people survived. The story began to circulate on Tory Island was a cursing stone, and the story began to circulate that the islanders had put a curse on the on the ship, and that's why it sank. There are other stories as well. So Tom, you know, spent 3 years writing the novel, and I write a one-page poem. It's called Knucklebones. We cross to Tory, walk the island, talk to the king, climb inside the lighthouse wall illegally. But my grandfather played here, my great-grandfather kept the light. This place feels like home. We search for the rock where she sank with 50 souls, find the cursing stone. Not the stone itself, long lost or buried or cast away, red to the heart with blood, but the slanted slab of rock, as long as a man, where the cursing stone once rested and was turned. Or not. There is another story. There was only one crime in a lighthouse keeper's life, one sin without forgiveness. There is a rumour, always denied, but on the night of the sinking, the light was out. On our last night on the island, we leave the pub. The islanders are only starting. and see her, a constant housewife sweeping the darkness away, stretching skyward to the northern star, seaward to Inishtrahull, to Fannet and Arranmore, and downward to the jagged bed where the bones of 50 sailors tinkle, rolled between pebble and stone, where fish eggs are laid in hollow thighs, where hermit crabs try vertebrae for size, and the ghosts of dead sailors play knuckle bones.